conspiracy theories are usually false. Generally speaking, the implication of a conspiracy theory that there is a small group of people that controls a society and is trying to twist that society for its own ends does not hold up scrutiny, especially in large, complex liberal democracies. But conspiracies are not always false. Sometimes, in fact, conspiracies do exist. They're usually not a secret, and people are usually right out in the open about what they want to do. What I mean by a conspiracy in this sense is an attempt to subvert people, a group of people, an organization, a country, a political party or movement, against its will or against its own interests, for your own broader underlying ends. By this metric, there has been a conspiracy emanating from the very highest circles of Russia, aimed against the right in the United States and much of Europe. This conspiracy is very, very close to Vladimir Putin, and may or may not have been the architects behind the invasion of Ukraine in 2014. What I'm talking about here is nothing more or less than an attempt to capture and subvert conservative elements in most of European society for the goal of creating a new ultra-powerful Russian empire. And while this conspiracy is unlikely to succeed, it has poisoned and corrupted many otherwise worthy institutions on the right in many countries, and has struck at the very Christian chords of conservative movements around the Western world. At the heart of this conspiracy is not Vladimir Putin, who is himself not a particularly ideological figure. No, the person behind this conspiracy, who, again, it's not a secret, has been very open about what he's trying to do, is a man you've probably never heard of. But if you're familiar at all with the alt-right or other strange new movements that seem to be bubbling out of conservatism, if you are somebody who's on the right and you look around at your movement and you realize that you seem to have ended up in a foreign country and you're not sure how, this guy's probably behind it. His name is Alexander Dugin, and we can't understand what's happening in Ukraine and the way some of the right is responding to it without understanding his pernicious influence. Alexander Dugin is, from the perspective of conservative Christianity, the most dangerous man you've never heard of. His threat is insidious, his doctrines are widespread, and he is specifically coming to undermine that which we hold dear as Christians. Be aware and be informed. I'm Dr. Nolte, and for Blind Politics, this is Eye on Ukraine. Welcome, podcast listeners, to another episode of Blind Politics with Dr. Nolte. And this is sort of part of our ongoing coverage of Eye on Ukraine, as you might have been able to tell from the theme song and from the introduction. But this episode is a little bit different because it goes far beyond just the situation in Ukraine. It really covers more of some of the background of what's happening in Russia and Russia's influence operations around the world. But we are Blind Politics. I am Dr. A.J. Nolte, Assistant Professor of Government at Regent University's Robertson School of Government. Once again, views expressed in this podcast do not represent those of either Regent University or the Robertson School of Government. Please remember you can rate and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast provider. You can find us on Facebook at Blind Politics with Dr. Nolte and on the Facebook and Instagram feeds of the Robertson School. I first read about Alexander Dugin when I was studying Russian nationalism in grad school at Catholic University of America. The course was Russia, Europe, and the World, and I was writing a paper on Russian nationalism's international influence. Russian nationalism is a complex phenomenon, especially in the post-Soviet sphere. And there are a number of different strands of Russian nationalism, from your garden variety ethno-nationalist skinheads to some very, very interesting figures within the Russian Orthodox world. We might think here of the Russian oligarch Konstantin Malafeyev, probably not pronouncing that correctly. But when we're talking about the international projection of and geopolitical vision of Russian nationalism, then we are talking squarely about Alexander Dugin. So I've been studying Dugin since 2006, 2007, give or take. And I remember when I first read him thinking that this was an absolutely insane person. And then moving on, because I was mostly a Middle East guy. I wanted some sort of, you know, Russia background. It was a course. I needed an elective. It was interesting. The Dugin stuff was crazy, right? And then he kept coming up. Obviously, I am somebody who teaches on, writes on, and is involved with the intellectual debates on the right. And what I started noticing, as you start to see the radical traditionalists, neo-romantics, you know, neo-reactionaries, and other figures that would later become the alt-right, was that many of them had influence from, or were influenced by, or were interested in the thought of Alexander Dugin. Most of these people were very devout Orthodox Christians, and as you will soon understand, this really confused me, because you can say a lot of things about Alexander Dugin, but he is not an Orthodox, Trinitarian, traditional-believing Christian. He's pretty open about this. He's been open about it since at least the 1980s. But what I found was that people were taking at face value Dugin's claims to be advocating for traditionalism, and not necessarily looking deeper at what he actually meant by that. Tradition is a word that gets thrown around a lot in conservative circles, and we all seem like and think that we're talking about the same thing. But Dugin's idea of tradition is very different from the idea that you or I might have. It was interesting, as I started talking to some folks on the alt-right, on message boards and things like that, particularly some elections boards that I follow, asking them if they're familiar with Dugin's thought, and then getting an understanding that, in fact, they agreed with him about some of these aspects that were not necessarily Christian. One of the worst-kept secrets about the alt-right is that most of its more prominent figures are not actually Orthodox Christians. They're either Christian heretics, they're neo-pagans, or, well, people like Dugin, and we'll come back to that in a second. So it became very clear to me that there were these deep Russian links with the alt-right, which is part of the reason that I was as Trump skeptical as I was back in 2016. Not necessarily that Trump himself was a target of Russian influence operations. I never thought that was credible because, quite frankly, Trump is the last person that I would recruit if I was trying to run a covert operation on just about anything. Love him or hate him, whatever his skill set might be, secret keeping and keeping secret that you have a particular special relationship with a foreign government is just not the way Trump operates. So that never made any sense to me. But insofar as there were alt-right folks in his orbit and influence, I was a little bit concerned that some of their crazy ideas might get play in the Trump administration. Fortunately, those concerns turned out to be not as well-founded as they might have been. And we saw a much more traditional foreign policy and social policy from the Trump administration than we might have. But I've had my eye on Dugin and his supporters for quite some time. Now it has become clear that, in fact, Dugin's influence on Vladimir Putin and Vladimir Putin's grand strategy is greater than I first thought. While I don't necessarily think Putin himself is an ideologue, I think he has a very traditional sense of Russian nationalism, where he's aggrieved by the collapse of the Soviet Union, aggrieved by the weakness of what has happened in Russia since then, and wants to reconstitute Russia as a great, if not the great, power in the world. If that's your primary overriding ambition, and if you are at least Eastern Orthodox curious enough to want to use something like that as the religious trappings of the state ideology, then Dugin is extremely useful to somebody like Putin. And in fact, he has been very prominent in Putin's ideological circles and so on and so forth. So who is Alexander Dugin? What does he believe? And why does he concern me as much as he does? Dugin is the son of an intelligence officer. He's about 60 now, so born in the 60s. In the 1980s, he went to, I believe it was Moscow University. He teaches at Moscow University now. But he became involved with a group called the Yuzhinsky Group. The Yuzhinsky Group was a group of dissidents that were attracted to occult and Satanist ideas. Yes, you heard me right. In his younger days, Alexander Dugin was a Satanist and an occultist, and he hasn't moved that far away from that since then. But we'll come back to that. In this time period, he was sort of a hipster Nazi, which is kind of the zeitgeist of a lot of online, sort of Charlottesville folks, right? So he was kind of in that vein. But he became influenced by the thought of an Italian thinker known as Julius Evola. Now, Evola himself is a whole nother interesting cat. He is a philosopher, political philosopher, a so-called traditionalist, but he's heavily influenced by mysticism and Gnostic philosophy and Gnostic thought. Now, what is Gnosticism? Because this is going to come up a lot, and it's really important to understand Gnosticism if you're trying to understand Alexander Dugin. Gnosticism is a second century Christian heresy that is often associated with more modern mystical movements, spiritualist movements, and so on and so forth. but it also is associated particularly with political expressions of those movements, and particularly with political expressions of those movements that are a little bit conspiratorial. And as I break down the core tenets of Gnosticism, you'll start to see why. Gnostics believed that there was a hidden spiritual truth contained within the broader message of Christianity that was not available to most Christians. The average Christians, or psychics, were okay with just having the sort of idea, this fable about Jesus Christ being born and God incarnate and the resurrection and salvation and all of that jazz. But the Gnostics, those with true gnosis or knowledge, recognized that this was nothing more than a pious fable. After all, from the Gnostic perspective, this physical world was wholly and entirely evil. Souls were trapped in that world, and the purpose of Christ was to free us from that entrapment in the physical. So the incarnation, the resurrection, all of that stuff, well, that's just a fable. The reality is that the meaning of Christ, according to the Gnostics, was to free enlightened souls from the trappings of physical reality. So we have here this idea of a hidden corpus of Christian meanings and Christian teachings hidden from the vast majority of Christians, and that pertained to the idea of freeing the soul from the bonds of materiality. This was seen as the worst threat to Christian orthodoxy by just about everybody in the early church. When the first century Saint Irenaeus writes his Against Heresies, he is taking square aim at Gnosticism. And one of Irenaeus' points is that, in fact, we can tell that there's no hidden teaching from the apostles. Why? Because, as Irenaeus points out, I was taught by Polycarp, who was taught directly by the apostle John, who taught you, you crazy Gnostics. In other words, if there was a secret hidden teaching, don't you think I would know about it? Well, there's not. Irenaeus lays out the marks of Catholicity. In other words, how can you know that a church is actually part of the universal church and not get sucked into this nonsense about hidden teachings? And all the signs of Catholicity are public, things like a common canon or list of the books of scripture that they're reading, a common rule of faith or list of teachings, common descent from the apostles, the idea of apostolic succession, and a common way of worship or common liturgy. The Gnostics, of course, are against all of this and are talking about how they have these hidden gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, and all these other later documents that come about. Gnosticism is defeated by Orthodox Christianity, but it never really goes away, so much as it sort of seems to go underground, and it keeps reemerging in odd places and odd times. The Cathars were accused of being Gnostics. This was a heretical movement in 11th or 12th century France. There are accusations of Gnosticism that are tied in with the Templars and Freemasons. These accusations are not always true, but whenever you have a secret society, it does tend to put the authorities in the church in mind of Gnosticism, particularly if you have hidden beliefs or hidden rituals and so on and so forth. Yeah, that's going to be associated with Gnosticism. Whether or not this long-term association is true, it does create in the minds of later mystics, people in the Enlightenment and Romantic era, that there is this hidden tradition of mysteries that are passed down, but that are kept hidden from the vast majority of Christians. This is what Gnostics mean by traditionalism or the tradition. This then gets tied in with the idea of theosophy in the 19th century. Theosophy is the notion that hidden within all religion is a kernel of universal truth. Now, you might be thinking that Gnosticism and theosophy, when combined, would necessarily lead to sort of a left-wing movement. And in fact, we can see some elements of theosophy, Gnosticism, the idea of an inner or hidden spirituality, a universal mystical truth, on the left-wing or sort of the more religious modernist side of things. But this is also the age of romantic nationalism, of Hegel and of German literature that's valorizing the nation and French literature that's valorizing the nation and so on and so forth. And so this idea of romanticism, of romantic nationalism, also starts to kind of creep its way into theosophist, I think is the right term, and occult traditions. Julius Evola comes out of the school a little bit later on, and he's arguing for a Gnosticism that is sort of the mystic heart of the blood and soil nationalisms that are emerging at the time. Okay? So this idea of the land, the religion of the land, becomes important for Evola and is really, really important for Dugin. What is the religion of the land? The religion of the land is essentially the primitive faith that has always existed in the land, that is the faith of those who are connected to the soil and who sort of have the soil in their blood, hence blood and soil. It can be found in multiple different religions, according to this idea, and it's the idea of a sort of mystic or hidden core to this religion, the mystic core to the mystic bonds, right? So this is a sort of sacralization of the land and the people through an ancient tradition that is carried in many different religions. This is certainly what Evola believed and is absolutely what Dugin believed. So Dugin's playing around with this occult stuff. He then becomes involved in politics. His first foray into political life was with the National Bolshevist Party. National Bolshevism apparently being a party for those who think that, you know, National Socialism is too namby-pamby for them. National Bolshevism is about as whacked out as it sounds, just based on the title. But at the core of National Bolshevism, as Alexander Dugin wrote in 1995, was Gnosticism, this idea of a hidden, mystical truth carried forward in many different religions. Now keep in mind, this is a dude who played with Satanism and the occult in his youth, in the 1980s. And as we'll find out moving forward, he doesn't really move that far away from those satanic and occult influences, despite the fact that he later portrays himself as, and tries to co-opt, conservative Christianity for his purposes. So Dugin is open to the idea that within Russia, Christianity might be the carrier of this hidden mystical or nationalist religion. He starts to associate himself with the old believers, those Russian Orthodox who rejected Western influences. Dugin's other hobby horse, aside from crazy Gnosticism and occult stuff, is what he calls geopolitics. This isn't geopolitics in the way that you might think of it, in terms of how does geography dictate the politics of great power competition and so on and so forth. This is geopolitics as an ideological framework. Very simply put for Dugin, geopolitics boils down to a Manichaean vision. The Manichaeans were a type of Gnostics who believed in a sort of dualistic fight between good and evil, where good and evil are equally strong as one another and are going to fight it out in a cosmic battle until the end of time. So Manichaean in this sense is descriptive in the sense that anybody who is really in a dualistic idea of, you know, there's this war in the world between good and evil is sometimes called Manichaean in a non-literal sense. But Dugin, you know, given his Gnostic background, might actually have some interest in straight up real unadulterated Manichaeanism. The other aspect of this Manichaean and Gnostic mix that you sometimes see, and certainly there in Dugin, is an apocalyptic vision. Gnostic movements are often apocalyptic. In other words, the battle between the true hidden religion and the false religions that are trying to keep the truth suppressed is going to come to a head in a great apocalyptic conflagration. So the Manichaean structure for Alexander Dugin is pretty simple. Land good, sea bad. In other words, countries that are based on the land, that are not sea powers but land powers, that are tied again with the mystic cords that tie you to the soil, that are not cosmopolitan but are traditionalist. Keep in mind we're talking about a Gnostic sense of tradition, not necessarily the tradition that you or I would think of, right? These are good. Sea powers, those that are more mercantile, materialistic, okay? Because remember, flesh bad, spirit good for Gnostic. Okay, so the land is a spiritual power. The sea power, because it's materialistic, because it's mercantile, is seen as a materialistic power, that are associated with these sort of universalist type religions that are not as tied to the land, which would be things like, you know, Christianity, certain types of Islam, although it's not always clear, but it's much more, it is as much geopolitical as it is anything else. Dugin sees the West, particularly the Euro-American West, the United States, and the European Union, and so on and so forth, as the ultimate sea power. The United States would certainly qualify as a major maritime power, and as a power whose empire, insofar as it exists beyond its own shores, is really born on the backs of maritime and trade. America's always been a commercial power, and so Dugin sees that as essentially the separation between Russia and the United States. Dugin's geopolitical philosophy is sometimes called Eurasianism. And the idea is that Russia should serve as the nucleus of a great Eurasian empire, spanning all of Europe and Asia, that will confront the dominant Western-centric American sea power, which is, of course, centered in the United States. Obviously, like any Russian nationalist, he sees the collapse of the Soviet Union as a great geopolitical catastrophe. So when Putin is talking about a geopolitical catastrophe in terms of the collapse of the Soviet Union, he may be talking about it in Duganist terms. So why is Dugin such a threat? Obviously, this guy just seems like he's kind of crazy. And by the way, it gets crazier. Because in some of his later writings, Dugin talks about the antipathy between the spirit of chaos, which he associates with good and the land and the spirit, and the opposing spirit of the sea powers and materialism and so on and so forth, which he associates with logos. The left-hand path of chaos as opposed to the path of logos. If you're a Christian who knows anything about Greek, this should be sending shivers up and down your spine, because we have a specific term for the spirit of chaos, or the Lord of chaos, who is opposed to the lordship of the Word of God, or Logos, Jesus Christ. Again, Dugin hasn't actually traveled that far from his roots. So why is Dugin such a problem? Well, partially because, in cooperation with Putin, Dugin's ideas have been exported. They've been exported to much of the rest of the Western world. And I believe they are the direct inspiration behind the alt-right. The alt-right takes as its central message the idea that the right has been corrupted away from a sense of ethno-racial realism by a sense of sort of universalism, and that the right needs the old right that is too mercantilistic needs to be taken over by the alt-right, which will move away from the ideas of free markets, the idea of mercantilism, of course, the sea power, and will move into sort of more of a racial realist or neo-reactionary position. The alt-right doesn't say very much about social conservatism, although they'll speak in terms of preserving tradition. They don't necessarily mean the same thing by that they might claim. And the reason they don't is because many of them are either some sort of Christian heretic, some sort of neo-pagan, or have bought into Dugin's idea that there's this unifying truth inside all religion. So they may portray themselves often as socially conservative Christians, but they don't mean by socially conservative Christianity what we would mean, that there is a core truth of Christianity revolving around the incarnation of Christ, his physical death, physical resurrection, and physical return. And that out of this, we can draw the idea of people being made in the image of God, which has specific implications for our beliefs about the sanctity of life, preservation of the family, and so on and so forth. What they mean by tradition is something entirely different, a mystical, spiritual heresy that ties things directly to blood, soil, and the land, and actually has nothing to do with Christian orthodoxy. I suspect, but can't prove, that most of the figures in the alt-right are either useful idiots for this, or they're knowingly hiding their beliefs and they actually agree with Dugin and his religious philosophies. It's very easy to skate over some of this stuff because Dugin's writings are voluminous. He writes a lot, and it's easy to miss some of his deeper sort of metaphysical and even occult ideas because they're often couched in terms of his support for conservative Christianity. But Dugin is definitely bad news, and Russia has been engaging in influence operations against conservative parties in several different countries. We know they've been very active in France, that they have tried to buy influence in different Eastern European countries, that there has been certainly an attempt, albeit a much less thorough and successful one, to infiltrate the United States in political parties, but that they have been trying to very broadly support some conservative and socially conservative organizations in the United States. So if you're socially conservative and a bunch of Russians are coming and offering you cash and saying that they just want to help preserve conservative Christianity and the family, you should probably look that gift horse in the mouth, because as you're going to find, it's got some Gnostic teeth. Now, this is not even necessarily to say that everybody who's in the Russian influence operations on the right milieu is necessarily on board with everything Dugin says. Like I mentioned at the outset of this, there is a devoutly Eastern Orthodox oligarch who's funded a bunch of this stuff, and I'm not sure that he's fully on board with Dugin's Gnosticism or is even aware of it. I'm not sure he's not either. I just don't know what that guy knows and what he doesn't. So I don't want to say everybody in the Russian sphere is necessarily a Duginist. But I will say this. The rise of alt-right type movements and the influence of a certain type of blood and soil nationalism within national conservatism, although it's not even, I don't know that that's the universal majority opinion among the NatCons. These things are very concerning. And they should give us a certain amount of pause, especially when we start hearing people talk about how great Putin is, right? I've discussed at length on this podcast the holes in the idea that Putin's Russia is a conservative, a Christian, an Orthodox place. But this is the biggest of them. One of Putin's chief ideologues is a Gnostic, an occultist, something close to a Satanist, although I don't know if he would be an Orthodox Satanist by the rather nebulous standards of that rather bizarre creed. But certainly, he is nobody's idea of a conservative Christian traditionalist. And his ideas, his fourth political theory, his, you know, warmed over national Bolshevism is something that comes up over and over and over again in alt-right media, in alt-right forums, and so on and so forth. So what can be done about this and what should we do about this? Number one, particularly as socially conservative Christians in the United States, we need to be vigilant and we need to examine carefully when people from other countries come to us and tell us that they agree with us on stuff. We don't necessarily just naively accept that. Do your due diligence and do your homework. Number two, we need to make sure that we are countering the influence of these Gnostic ideas. Because if you're thinking that the idea that there's this inner hidden spiritual reality and it's distinct from the physical and that the material is bad and should be gotten rid of or adapted to match the inner spirit, if you're thinking that has some bearing on transgender ideology, you'd be right. So this alt-right Gnosticism might be politically as far apart as it can be from woke transgender ideology, at least in theory. The underlying religious idea, the underlying theology, if we can call it that, is actually not that dissimilar. And that is something we should be very concerned about. If we're going to be Christian conservatives engaging in politics, Christian orthodoxy needs to come first. We need to make sure that we're solid, well catechized, and building our philosophies and our approaches out of core Christian doctrines, and not embracing doctrines that run directly counter to that and have been the arch heresy against which Christianity has pitted itself since the second century. Gnosticism is bad news. It is the old enemy warmed over. It is the thing against which Christians have been fighting the longest. And we need to not embrace it by the back door just because it might claim to be pro-life, pro-family, conservative, and fans of Donald Trump. That's less important. What's most important is our commitment to Christian orthodoxy. And it might be that we can be co-belligerent with people who are not Christians on all of those issues. I'm fine with that idea. But that doesn't mean we should embrace the ideas they hold that are not Christian. And if they're coming and trying to infiltrate us, that's a different story. I'm happy to be co-belligerent with Jews, Muslims, secularists, or people of any other faith if we agree on politics. But if you're trying to subvert my faith in that process, if you're portraying yourself as something that you're not, coming in as a wolf in sheep's clothing, that's a very, very different matter. We can work together. We can have respect for one another's faiths, but we need to recognize that they're different. And we're not going to come under false pretenses, pretending that you're an Orthodox conservative Christian when actually you are trying to infiltrate that faith with a doctrine that is a pernicious heresy and has been for a long time. So that's a key point. The other thing is, quite frankly, at this point, I think anybody who is repeating the talking points of the Kremlin or who is taking an actively pro-Putin position on the right needs to be viewed with a caution at best. I think that a significant portion of these folks are genuinely ignorant of what they've gotten themselves into. But then there are some that are not. There are some that are wolves in sheep's clothing. And we need to be very, very cautious about that. It is going to require discernment and, I would say, careful education of those who are in that camp who maybe don't really know what they've gotten themselves in for and what they've connected themselves with. But it's also going to require a direct confrontation of people who are, you know, maybe coming more from this alt-right perspective and getting them to actually unearth what they believe, especially if they're claiming it in the name of traditionalism or social conservatism or, you know, preserving Christian civilization. Okay? Christian civilization is a great thing, but a Christian civilization that has been stripped of the Orthodox faith once delivered is not a Christian civilization that is worth anything. It is a hollow shell that has had the heart ripped out of it. And so when someone says they're defending Christian civilization, it's probably a good question to ask, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by Christian civilization? And do you actually mean the faith once delivered? The inner truth of Christianity that has been publicly and outwardly proclaimed since the earliest days of the faith. That needs to be preserved. I emphasize this point because we're at a very dangerous moment as Christians in the United States and elsewhere. A dangerous moment in which our no-holds-barred conflict that seems to be there with many of these aggressively anti-Christian secular ideologies has led us to uncritically accept help from anybody who seems like they might be sympathetic. But that's a dangerous place to be in. The church has rarely ever, in its history, been defeated by an external foe. Let me say that again. The church has rarely ever, in its history, been defeated by an external foe. It has happened, but it's rare. And as long as Christians hold fast the faith, openly proclaim it, and seek converts, there's really nothing that secular society can do to us. If the oppression of communist China has not destroyed the faith in that country, and has in fact caused it to grow, then there's nothing that the secular world can do to us that will destroy the faith. That doesn't mean we shouldn't push back against it, if nothing else for the good of society around us, because Christianity itself is a good, and does good to those in the environment in which Christians operate. But it's not going to be the secular world that destroys the Christian faith. It has no power to stand against it. It's when we let wolves in sheep's clothing come in through the back door, when those who claim to be our friends are speaking poison and poisoning in the ears of the faith, that is what brings down the church. False doctrines, false gospels, preach from within the redoubts of Christianity. And those false gospels aren't just going to come in progressive blue state colors. We need to be very, very careful, particularly as conservative Christians, on our own side. Because we're not going to necessarily be tempted by the false gospels of progressivism. But if you can dress a false gospel up in conservative clothing, will we listen uncritically, accepting it as essentially the same thing that we believe in? Blurring the lines in ways that open us up to, once again, a triumph of Gnosticism. That's what makes Dugin so dangerous. The fact that he is claiming to be a supporter of the right, of traditionalism, an opponent of wokeness, and so on and so forth, that doesn't mean that he's actually a friend. His background should lead us to view him as an enemy agent. And I don't mean an enemy agent in the sense of being an agent of Vladimir Putin. I won't say this is what's at stake in the Ukraine conflict. Dugin was influential in the idea of bringing Ukraine into Russia as an administrative district of Russia, and has been a huge booster of this restored Russian state. But I will say this, the normalization of Putin, of Russia, and of the ideology that they're spreading is an extremely dangerous precedent. And so it's not just for all of these other reasons that it is important for us to push back. It's not just for the reasons we've discussed in this podcast in the past. But it's also because the ideology that is coming out of the Kremlin, that is trying to work its way into the right, is extremely dangerous. We've seen this movie before. Only last time it was on the left, as Marxism-Leninism tried to infiltrate, co-opt, and destroy from within many redoubtable institutions on the center-left in the United States, from labor unions to Hollywood to even a faction of the Democratic Party. There was a very close moment where a member of the Democratic Party, Henry Wallace, who was surrounded by Soviet infiltration, almost won the nomination. Thank God Harry Truman beat him for the nomination of the Democratic Party. Thank God FDR replaced Henry Wallace with Harry Truman before FDR died as vice president. But they came close. They came closer than we like to admit because, you know, just because Joseph McCarthy was wrong about a lot of stuff didn't mean that there was no attempted communist infiltration and that there was no success. The same people, not necessarily the same ideology, but the same people that did that are now the people that are running Russia. And they're trying to do the same thing on our side. We need to be aware, we need to be engaged, we need to be wary and cautious about this. We need to hold fast to the beliefs that we have, preserve the Christian faith as the heart of our social conservatism and of our Christian civilization. That doesn't mean that you need to necessarily support every aspect of fighting the Russians in Ukraine, but it does mean that you should view any sort of pro-Russian propaganda with a jaundiced eye, What are they trying to sneak in under the radar as a result of that? All right, that's going to be a wrap for this episode. Hopefully it's been educational. Hopefully it's been informative and a little bit bracing. I know I tend to be very skeptical of conspiracy theories, but again, this isn't a conspiracy theory that there's this hidden agenda, because the agenda is not hidden. They've been very open about it. They are just relying on our lack of awareness of this. They're relying on us not to be vigilant. And so if your vigilance has been raised against these sorts of pernicious ideas coming in, if you're a little bit more skeptical of anything that's coming under the banner of the alt-right as a result of this, if you are recognizing that we are perhaps engaging in a battle for the soul of the social conservative movement that doesn't run along David French and Sora Bomari lines, but runs along the lines of, are we going to embrace Orthodox Christianity or some facsimile that has nothing to do with it, right, within the social conservative Christian world? If you're more aware of that now, then I think I've done my job for this podcast. We're going to be back to a little bit more Ukraine-specific content in the next couple of episodes, as well as, I would say, probably a couple more that would be more in that sort of blind politics lane. So for blind politics and our ongoing coverage, sort of, kind of, eye on Ukraine, this is Dr. Nolte signing off.